grew up in Pierce County, Washington, which is close to the site of several company-owned or company-dominated communities, especially coal mining and timber. And then, as I was saying to this couple, in 1979, I worked for a forest products company in San Francisco that had had many camps, which is what they called them. And I have to tell you that part of what I was excited about was the romance of these little communities of 300 or 400 people that were accessible only by logging railway. And what happened to me that summer is someone came along with a box, dropped it on my desk, and they looked like Reader's Digest, but what they were the company monthly newsletters. And there was a page or two on each of the camps. And it would say things like, Bob and Leela Smith went out on Wednesday so that Bob could go to the dentist and Leela could go school shopping. And you know, it was a big deal. And it was a big deal for things like waiting for the mail to come in. And I was just charmed by that. And so eventually what I did was research about 300 communities in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and then a few in British Columbia. I would have done Northern California, but I had gone to the University of Washington Press up front and said, this is a project I want to do, and are you interested? And the general manager had said, yes, this would fill a niche in our line. We don't have a book like this. And indeed, the only other book was written in, I think it's based on a 1957 thesis, and it covered the entire West, everything west of the Mississippi. They said yes, they were interested, but I could not do Northern California. They were not, and I don't know if that's because the University of California has such a well-respected press at Berkeley, but they said no, you can only do the Northwest. So that eliminated all those communities near you. And in the book, there are approximately 105 communities. There are a lot of timber towns, there are mining towns, both hard rock like this is, and then there are coal mining communities. There are dam towns, such as Cooley Dam. There are there is one town for explosives that was built by DuPont. It was probably one of the first built in this area. And then there are war worker communities. So when we get to Q&A, if you want to talk about the differences between company towns, we can do that.
What was the last definition?
War worker.
War worker.
Richland, Washington, okay. Of course, was constructed. And then Henry Kaiser built a town on the Columbia called Vanport for Vancouver and Portland. And it was not really a town, but it was a community of, at one point, about 40,000 people that housed people who worked in the shipyards, primarily. In the beginning, you had to be a defense industry worker to live there. And part of the reason that I have it included is it came to a very dramatic end, which we can talk about, but also it was very similar to Richland. Mm. The way it was run was very similar. And you will see that when we get to that, if we talk more in detail. And it was very different than life here. What I want to talk about here is daily life during the mining days, because I'm assuming that's what some of you are interested in, what it was like to come here in 1937, say, and stay for 20 years, which some people did. What I find remarkable is that today life here is very different than most of the outside world, even if you exclude the religious and communal aspects. We don't have any phone or fax, and for many, many years, there was no internet connection, and we who come as short-term visitors still don't have that. There is no television, there are no stores or restaurants, there's limited electricity, there's a low-impact environmental focus, a tiny community with no nearby communities, handful of kids in school, very outdoorsy focus, and it's removed from trends, fashion and otherwise. By contrast, in mining days, things were pretty much the same here as they were in other small towns of the same era. What I found using the museum, which I hope you visited, reading the old miners, and up in the museum there are notebooks with copies of the miner newsletters that were published here. I interviewed a lot of people who had lived here, some as employees and many as children. I listened to the tapes, and then I read some theses, and I checked the state archives pretty thoroughly, especially to back up information. So what I found was it was a good-sized community. At its peak, it had several hundred people with more than 100 children in school. For example, in 1955, there were 211 children at a holiday party out of a Holden population of 450. They had the neighboring communities of Lucerne. Down where we come in, there was quite a thriving community. And then across the lake at Meadow Creek Lodge, there was a small community. And there was actually at least one child who commuted from there to school. Her father brought her over in a boat every morning. And there was at one point a one-room school down at Lucerne, but for much of the time period, the children came from Lucerne came up here to go to school. It had its own post office, it had its own library, it had the Fountain Lunch, which we know as the snack bar, so that was their restaurant. And after World War II, it had stores. Many of the people did rely on catalog shopping, but again, that was no different than many of us in that same era. I grew up in Parkland, in the suburb that's around Pacific Lutheran, and my mother was a real fan of the Sears Roebuck catalog. So even when we had stores accessible to us, we used that a lot. They had their own newspaper, and it continues even today. It comes out a few times a year, done by people who grew up here. They had very few phones, and they had almost no long distance. But that, again, was not unusual for the era, because even when the Lutherans came here in the early 60s, many small communities were relying on eight-party lines. My first job was in Lincoln County in eastern Washington, and everyone outside the downtown core was on an eight-party line, even in the 70s. And I think that when I lived in town, I had to just select to have a single-party line. They had dance bands, and in fact, there was a man named Cortland Bell who was the timekeeper and for many years the publisher of the newspaper, and he would watch when the bus came in, and he would see if anyone was carrying off a musical instrument because he was there to nab them for his dance band. And so, of course, with the dance band, they had casual and formal dances, and they had a wide variety of other social events. And one of the things they had that was typical of towns of the era were clubs, and more clubs. Just incredible number of clubs, both for adults and for children. If you've been up to the museum, you have seen the campfire uniforms or the vests, and then you've seen the Boy Scout uniform that hangs there. They did a lot of fundraising. Some years they sent $600 to the Chelan Hospital, and they sent $600 to Children's Orthopedic in Seattle, which is where all the sick kids went out to. For example, when polio came, that's where the kids were taken out to. They had sports teams and leagues. Often they had as many as four softball teams organized by department, and that would have been for the men alone, and I don't know what they had for women. The women did a lot of bowling. Bowling was just incredibly popular in most small towns, and in almost every company town that I studied, there was a bowling alley, very similar to what we have. Waiting for the mail was a ritual. The bus came up from Lucerne at noon. Sometimes it was operated as a franchise by the one of the tavern keepers and landlords in Lucerne, and people would come and wait for the mail. Well, the man who ran the store after the war said that that was great because women would come and they'd pull their children on sleds, and then they would stop at the store while they were waiting for the mail. And so, of course, he did a little bit of business that time of day. And despite weather and location, people dressed just like people in more metropolitan areas. If you've seen some of the pictures, especially there's a picture of the school teachers on the last day of school forever in 1957, and you will notice that they are all dressed just like the teachers that we all had, with the full skirts and everything pressed. So what impressed me as I interviewed people and I researched this was that many people did come and they did stay. Some people stayed for the entire 20 years that the mine operated. And it might have been because remote locations were typical for the mining industry, and as camps went, Holden was a very nice camp. There were some people I interviewed, some who had been born as children in mining camps in Canada, and then this was the next stop for them. And then they went on in adulthood to live in hard rock mining communities. So this was their entire experience, living in these isolated communities. And today I work with someone who lived in 14 mining camps in North and South America as a child, 14 different locations in the 18 years before she went to college. So, and she's just a little bit younger than most of the people who grew up here. So she's in her late 60s. So again, I think that was very typical of mining engineers. And certainly mining laborers. During the Depression, this was a very comfortable place to live, and people could accumulate savings because virtually all of your needs were taken care of, and you didn't have many opportunities to spend money. So there were a lot of people who came here, and when they left, they really had a stash for buying a home outside and getting established. And then the other thing that happened was about midway through World War II, the government realized that they needed to offer draft deferments to men who were involved in copper mining. So yet another reason to stay here, or to come here during the war. Another thing that impressed me was that many people expected to live like their friends and family elsewhere. Particularly that was true of the people who lived in the circle, the management staff. They packed in silver tea sets, they packed in bone china, and believe it or not, they packed in pianos. One of the women that I interviewed who had been born in Premier, British Columbia, when they came in here, they brought their piano down from Premier, and I guess it was probably on a train, and then it was barged up Lake Chelan, and then you can imagine schlepping a piano up. And there were several, because there were a lot of women who gave piano lessons. So it was not atypical. They set up movie projectors, and they showed films three times a week. And the only big difference between this and other company towns was it was much more expensive to go to the movies. In that era, you could go to the movies elsewhere for 10 or 15 cents a person, where here at one point they were charging 65 cents because it cost so much to bring the films up the lake. They organized children's Christmas parties and Easter cantatas, and they imported big city bands and big city fashion for the New Year's Eve balls, which were primarily for married couples. The single miners would not have gone to those events because they had no way to bring a date in. You know, think about it, I don't think that they had the opportunity to put up a date in the hotel, and the few references I found to dates being brought in was when a family offered to put up somebody's date. And there were a few situations like that, and there were very few marriages here that did not involve people who were both here already. But they truly did. They brought in bands, especially from Spokane, for these dances. And the women told me that they did things like put their feet on a piece of paper and trace around it, and then send the tracing in to either the Crescent in Spokane or Frederick and Nelson in Seattle. And the shoes were sent out on approval, along with the dresses. And you know, this sounds unusual, but when I grew up in Tacoma, and we did not have a Frederick and Nelson, and we didn't even have a Nordstrom in those days. And you could dial up Frederick and Nelson, and they would send things out of approval because they advertised. I don't remember if they advertised in the Tacoma paper, but many of us took the Seattle morning paper, and I can remember my mother doing that. So again, it was not atypical of the era. One of the things that I was really impressed by was that going out was a major excursion. I came here the first time when my younger child was six, and I thought it was a major project to get here. And what these people went through and they went out dressed up was really a project. If you lived at Honeymoon Heights, everybody knows where Honeymoon Heights is? Honeymoon Heights is up that-a-way. It's a 3/4 mile trail. It's very steep. It was the site of the original mining camp in the early 30s. And what happened when the newlywed mining engineers came here, they weren't eligible to live in the circle. They didn't want to live in Winston with the laborers. And so they and their brides took over that area. And some of them did not leave until they had children. What happened was, as they were promoted, they would move down. And it was closed entirely in 47. But so you could walk down the 3/4 mile in the dust or in the snow, all dressed up and possibly with a baby or with young children. And they weren't doing it with Nikes. And if you lived in Winston, the miners' village, you walked, and you know, obviously it was level most of your way, but you were still walking. And then at the village, you caught the bus to Lucerne, just as people do today. The bus was scheduled to meet people arriving at Holden, so you had to wait at Lucerne until the boat was returning down lake, which meant that you were all dressed up and you had to keep your children busy, safe, and clean while you waited for the boat. And one of the women I spoke to who had three little boys said that was a huge project. I mean, you could just imagine trying to keep them looking nice. If you were going out by car, you would have driven your car to Lucerne and had it you would have driven onto a platform, and the platform would have been hoisted on to the barge in advance of your trip, because you were going out on the passenger boat and the car went out on the barge. What they did was they put the ore canisters on the barge first, and then the cars were hoisted atop that. And I do have a picture in the book of that. I was just fascinated by how that worked.
Did a lot of people have private cars?
After the war, it was more likely that you had cars. Some people kept their cars in Chelan in a rented garage year-round, and when the snow fell, you were required to take your car out unless you had a special position. And there were very few people who had positions which involved having a car year-round. And in that case, you had a garage because of the weight of the snow. Most people, once they got to Chelan, had to catch a bus to Wenatchee to catch the train. And due to the schedules, you usually had to stay overnight in Chelan, both coming and going. You couldn't take the boat to Chelan, spend a few hours shopping, and then catch the next boat home, because there was no next boat. And in some years, the boat didn't even run every day. It only ran three times a week. And despite that, there were people who did go out regularly. The shopkeeper and his wife went out to buy and to get their daughter to orthodontistry appointments. And some families went to Seattle to shop and to visit relatives. And of course, the high school and college kids went out for school. There was never a high school here, and so kids who lived there either had to do correspondence or they moved away after eighth grade. And in most cases, they moved away. There were a lot of families who considered it unacceptable, but it was not that unusual. Again, in that era, in the 30s and the 40s in particular, there were all sorts of little boarding schools around the state. And many of the schools which exist today as private schools had boarding programs. In Seattle, for example, several of the Catholic schools had rooms in the top of the school, say, where the kids lived with the nuns. What some Holden families chose was a forerunner of the commuter marriage. The wife moved out with a high school-age child, leaving the husband and the younger children behind. And of course, that usually meant that the wife had to get a job elsewhere, because they were at that point supporting two incomes. And some wives went out for their own education, which I found very interesting. Florence Field, who was the principal here for 19 of the 20 years, and is now over 100 years old and still living in Chelan, started to teach as a 17-year-old, and so she continued her education virtually every summer. And her husband operated the crane down at the dock, and they lived in Miners Village. And they actually sent their own daughter out to live with her grandparents at Fields Point. That's where that name comes from, because Mrs. Field did not want to have her own daughter in her class. So Mary Ellen did not live here much of the time. And then Harriet Wilbur was a woman who came in the early 50s with two small children, and then had a third while here. And her husband won the Irish sweepstakes, or ran $1,000 in the Irish sweepstakes 1 year. And I think it was that money that paid for her to go to what is now Western Washington University in Bellingham, and get her teaching credentials. And she packed up her three little kids, and I think her husband drove her to Bellingham with them. Remember, narrow with no car seats. And she had the two older children enrolled in a lab school on the campus, and she had a babysitter for the baby. And she did that at least one summer, and then she came back and started subbing in the school and eventually taught, and then she taught in Chelan when they left. Her husband was the office manager, and they lived in, I think it was 12,
I had this noted someplace. And many families sent their kids out by themselves. They went to boarding school. They went to board in Chelan. You know, they rented rooms from people. Or they went to relatives. And some of the people I talked to said that was not necessarily great socially. Duran, Gordon, whose father was the superintendent, and so would have been the highest paid person here, she went to Annie Wright Seminary in Tacoma, and she said she always felt that the resident, not the other girls who were boarding, but the girls who lived in Tacoma were day students, were sort of disdainful of her, because that was a pretty affluent group. And she said, you know, they had the cashmere sweater sets and the nylon stockings, and she was wearing cotton stockings and dresses that her mother might have made. And I interviewed other women who said that they felt the same way. And Janet Adams, whose brother Nigel wrote the history of the production, she was sent to relatives, and she said she was so homesick she cried for 2 weeks. And finally her aunt packed her up and sent her back, and Mrs. Field had her as a helper for 2 weeks here and got her mentally in shape, emotionally in shape, to send her back to board with relatives. But, you know, they were coming out of a very tight-knit community and going to something completely different. Just to give you an example of what some of these 14-year-olds did, Bill Phillips, whose parents were here for 19 of the 20 years, and they actually started in a tent house where we have the Labyrinth. It was a ball field at the time, and they lived there, they lived at Lucerne, they lived at Honeymoon Heights, they lived in Miner's Village, and then eventually they lived in the Circle when his father was promoted. He attended Seattle's Lakeside School as a boarder, so his responsibility was to get himself to the Greyhound station in downtown Seattle from Lakeside, which is in the north end. He would take a late bus and he would arrive in Wenatchee in the morning, and then he had to get himself on the bus to Chelan in time to catch the boat up lake. And then when his brother started at Lakeside, they did it together. But I'm just floored, you know, what people did. And Duran would have to stay at Campbell's Lodge overnight, and that was a very small operation in those days. And she told about how the Campbell boys would pull the fire alarm because then the girls would come out of their rooms in their 90s or their underwear. But Mrs. Campbell would kind of keep an eye out for the girls, because here they were 14 or 15 and they were traveling on their own. And some of the kids, especially people like Duran, whose father was the superintendent, the downlake agent would kind of watch out for them, and I think sometimes he picked them up in Wenatchee and drove them to Chelan and left them at Campbell's then. So there were some perks if you were, you know, a different level. Grocery shopping was something that fascinated me. Everybody I talked to about Company Town Life, I said, well, so how did you handle basics like grocery shopping? At Holden in the pre-war era, there was a commissary where the laundromat is now, and there were just basic, very basic supplies. When you were hired, you stopped in Chelan on your way up lake and you opened an account at one of the grocers. And that was how you got your groceries. You sent your order down in the mail once a week. The groceries were delivered to the dock and then they were barged up. And if you didn't have an account, you'd been paying cash, there would be an envelope of change in your order. The boxes of groceries were stacked on the dock here at Lucerne, in the order that they were to be delivered to the houses, and a House Sound employee trucked them up and then delivered them to each house. And if you lived at Honeymoon Heights, your groceries went up in what was called the skip, which was a steel box a little over 7 feet long and about, I think it was 2 feet wide, and I guess it was 2 feet high, I'm not sure. And it was an aerial, you know, it was attached to a cable. And then the issue was if it skipped on the cable. And in some of the memoirs, they talk about the year that it skipped and flipped, and all sorts of white bread went all over the valley. But they were never quite sure that their stuff was going to get there.
Man, no. Manna from heaven.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that wildlife thought of it that way.
And another thing that interested me was what happened during the war. And during the war, they had to send their ration books down with their orders, and then the ration books came back. After the war, part of Lodge 6 was converted to a grocery. It would be this, the end nearest us. And it got deliveries only once a week, so some of the merchandise was not fresh. If you wanted something that the store did not ordinarily carry, you requested it from the manager, who asked the store owner to send it up from Chelan. And they also carried some basics like diapers. Many families continued to order from Chelan because they felt the quality was better. And obviously, like in any other home of that era, there was a lot of baking and canning done. What one woman said she recalled from the war years was her mother had the fruit and somebody else had the sugar. And so she made the jam and then split it with the person who had had the sugar. And there were women who got together and washed their clothes together. That was a question I never could get answered, was many of the people were operating with gas-powered washing machines, which is, again, very, very typical in communities that did not have a lot of electricity. And many timber communities had no electricity except one went to the sawmill. And so you could, I've forgotten how late, you could order your Maytag with either a gas-powered engine or an electric motor. So people, I don't know how they got their gas. Somebody said he thought they probably had a special allocation for the things, because you wouldn't have had a car. And you had to have it to run your washing machine.
Was it gas or propane, or what did it run off of?
No, it was regular gas.
It was regular gas. Mm-hmm.
Fridges were sometimes propane. Mm-hmm. Now, there for other shopping, there was somewhat of a general store where the bookstore is now. So think about the bookstore. It was opened by Fred Wigbers, who was a miner who had come here with one eye, and then he lost the second eye in a mining accident. And it was called the Variety Store. He had guns, he had ammunition, he had fishing gear, he had licenses, he had appliances, he had toys at Christmas, he had lots of army surplus stuff. And the postmaster shared the space, and he sold the magazine subscriptions, which of course Fred couldn't sell. Where the laundromat is today, starting in the early 50s, was Helene's Dress Shop. And she had originally run a shop in a spare room in her home. And the postmaster's wife, a woman named Ruth Holzhauer, sold gift items in her home, china, vases, teapots, sort of gift things, nicer quality than what was in the variety store. Many of the people I interviewed talked about the snow. And those of you who've been here at other times of the year know about the snow. One year, the town was written up in Life magazine because it had more than 50 feet, which was double the usual snowfall. And it was because of the snow that the cars either went to Lucerne to be garaged or they went to Chelan. And partly that was because of the load, but the other reason was because of where the snowplows operated. And there is a picture in the book that shows what we think of as Main Street, and there's very little street. I mean, it's almost a tunnel because there was so much snow. And groceries were sometimes delivered to the miners' village by sled during those years with the snow. And laundry lines were strung very high, often outside second-story windows. So one woman I talked to said they had like an attic window, and they had one of those lines with a pulley, and it was attached to either, depended on the home, either a tree or a neighboring house. And then her mother would go up into this attic and hang the clothes out, and they would freeze dry, and then she would pull them in and finish it on wood racks around the floor furnace. But they had to do that because if you'd had a line in your backyard, you would have been covered with snow, buried in snow by the time winter came. Despite the weather, people still dressed up. Patty Tappan, whose father was the number two person, remembered how her mother developed something like chains, tire chains, to put on her galoshes so that she could walk in the snow. And this last year in Seattle, we had terrible snow, and they actually were selling these boot chains. Mm-hmm. And I thought of Mrs. Haddon and thought, oh, she was just, you know, 60 years before her time. Avalanches were a real danger, both on the hills and then between the village and Winston and between the village and Lucerne. The children, when they left school, they were always escorted between the school, which was Narnia, and the miners' village. And there was this, I believe they walked right next to the wall of snow so that if an avalanche came, the idea was that it would go over them. And then the issue between here and Lucerne was that often the road was blocked and the either the commuter bus that carried the laborers or the mail bus could not get through. And so what a lot of people did was they would get a ride up to the slide, they would walk over the slide, and then they'd get picked up on the other side. And there's talk about people who would sling the mailbag, and that's how it got up. The snow was so deep that many houses had very little light most of the winter. One of the first times I was here, I went to the house at the top of the circle where the Phillips family had lived, number 9. And of course, that's the highest house. And the people who were then volunteering on long-term staff showed me where the snow had been on the dining room window the previous winter. Just almost no light. And the people traveled between the buildings through what were basically roofless tunnels. At Honeymoon Heights, one couple had to slide into their living room from outdoors when winter came. There was not a lot of plumbing up at Honeymoon Heights, and they came very, I think they probably came in 37, and so they had an outhouse. So for their entire first year of married life, when it was snowy, they were sliding into the living room when they went to the outhouse. One characteristic of company towns that was very common here was company subsidy of many expenses. Here, in particular, it was wood for fuel. The Forest Service marked the trees that could be felled, and then the men went out in teams, and they cut their assigned trees into stove-sized logs and stacked them, and then the company truck would come down and pick up the load, you know, say for you, and it would deliver it to your house, and then you would split it. Room and board charges were very, very modest. In an era when men were making between $155 and $250 a month, they were paying $1.20 for room and board. And when they were making, say, about $8 an hour, they were paying $1.80 for room and board. So a very small percentage of their income went for room and board. As far as housing, the company financed construction of many of the houses in Winston. But what I found very interesting is it also controlled the sales prices. The company policy was that you could not speculate in real estate. So if you paid $1,000 for your house and you could document that you had put in $200 worth of improvements, you were allowed to sell it for $1,200 when you left or when you moved to the circle. The houses in the circle went with a job, so when a man was promoted, his family moved. The higher-up managers who lived in the lower houses paid no rent. At the top of the circle in the 1950s, the rent was $21 a month, which is roughly comparable to what people were paying in Richland at the same era. The recreation hall, which we call the village center, was built by the company, and some expenses were covered by the recreational association dues. So again, it was a facility that was available to many people. And the dues in 1948 were 75 cents per month. And other income for the Recreational Association was generated through the movie concession, which paid 10% of its gross to the community club. So they had a few other sources of income. The newspaper was printed on the company mimeograph. And there was a payroll category for donating to others. And this, again, was fairly common in company towns. It was a little bit of a United Way sort of thing, where you designated a certain portion of your paycheck to different things. In some communities, that was how the minister was supported. And here, typically, when there was a death in the family, the miners could go in and say, I want $1 or $2 or $5 out of my next paycheck to go to the XYZ family. There's a woman who comes in July every year and volunteers named Linda Jensen, And if you've seen the picture of the 4th of July parade, she's a baton twirler out in front because she was part of the baton twirling group here as a girl. Her father dropped dead of a heart attack, and she said it was the donations through this payroll scheme that paid for their trip out, because as you may have noticed, there is no cemetery here and there is no church. So they went out and the funeral was held somewhere down lake. And then, of course, they had to spend at least one night, and then they came back in. So that's how that was covered. Another thing that the company did was it released employees for an hour or two to teach in the school. It might have been something like geology. You know, the geologists might have been allowed to do that, or it might have been something like woodworking. What was more typical of normal towns is the company did not house the teachers at its expense. In many towns, that was true. What the Howell Sound tried to make sure happened was that Chelan County, and this, it was the Holden District, I think, for a while, but then it became part of Chelan County. They tried to ensure that wives of employees who already had housing were the teachers. And in the case of Mrs. Field, Mrs. Field was hired, and then a job was provided for her husband, and then they were expected to provide their own housing in Miner's Village. Very late in the life of the town, one of the lodges had apartments created. Some of you have maybe been in the rooms where there's a door, so there were two rooms mm-hmm. that were adjoined. And Mrs. Getty, whose husband Oscar ran the rental cabins down at Lucerne, and he ran a pack train, she came up here and stayed. She and her daughter shared an apartment. Mrs. Getty taught, and her daughter was the nurse. But in general, there was no housing provided for teachers. They did have company money, a script, and here it was called tin. They were discs of tin. And many towns, timber towns, they were sometimes wood. Many towns, they were coupons. But here, they were metal discs, and they were accepted almost everywhere here, except one place. And they were accepted at some stores down lake. They were issued in the grocery store after it opened. And of course, that was a wonderful marketing device for the grocery store, because you had to go in to get your tin issued. And it was issued as an advance against your salary. Now, can you imagine the one place? How many of you have been in the pool hall? There's one place that you could not use the tin.
Is there a bar or something?
The slot machines. You had to have real money for the slot machines. And the slot machines operated until the state of Washington really cracked down on gambling. And that was an unfortunate situation here, because it was the proceeds from the slot machines which paid for the children's gifts at Christmas. At the all-company party, I remember somebody saying that he had gotten an Erector set one year when they were still using the proceeds from the slot machines, and the next year all the children got boxes of applets and cotlets. Big difference. And recreation, typical of small towns, there was a lot of things going on. Here, much of it was wholesome. They had lots of sports, they had hiking, they had skiing, they had fishing, snowballing. Sledding down the road on moonlit nights. The man who was the storekeeper said he remembered they'd come out of the movies and they'd go home, and the storekeeper had an apartment behind the store, so it was close to home. Bundle up, and then they would sled on the roads because the trucks weren't running. They had things like cribbage tournaments where they moved from house to house, and lots of potluck suppers. One of the things I thought was really interesting was that they had classes like square dancing, and they used records, and the records had the calls. So I guess you just coordinated, and if you couldn't keep up with the calls, you were in trouble, or maybe they started the records over. At Christmas, when the high school and college kids came home, they had challenge basketball games, you know, kids against adults. Dances were very common, but children were not permitted on the dance floor until they were 16, which again, as I said, meant that many single minors did not have dances, didn't attend them. But there was some dating. The daughters of the mining managers, the people who lived in the circle, told me how they kept track of the Ivy League students who arrived for the summer jobs. Howell Sound in the later years was owned by a company based in New York, and so it was very common that the executives there shipped their sons out
for jobs in the mining industry. And one woman said she worked in the post office, and so it's great to keep track of all these young guys. And another one worked in the dining hall. For years, they had the slot machines, and they also had a nonstop card game. And there were some of the prissier women that I interviewed said, the adults, said that they perceived some of the people as gambling away everything they made, you know, the single miners. There was also homebrew, not, of course, in the bunkhouses, but elsewhere. And then there was a recreational facility called Edgemont Lodge, 3 miles up lake, which was owned by a man named O.B. Brown, who had a music store in Wenatchee. And has anybody heard about Edgemont? Edgemont was run by Mr. Brown's so-called wayward son. It was served by the Lady of the Lake as a flag stop, and it brought in prostitutes at payday. And so there used to be a sign in the pool hall that said Edgemont. Is it still there? I haven't been down there to look. But people would say, I mean, what was Edgemont? I think at one point it was built as a legitimate lodge, and then it... And I had a lot of trouble getting information on this, and I was at
Everybody admits they used to went there, right?
Yeah. Actually, I wrote a note to someone who was an executive here, and he was then in his 80s, and he very furiously denied that it ever existed. But I was at Bumbershoot in Seattle working at a booth, and someone came up, and I told him about my project, and I said, and what I'd really like to know about is Edgemont. And he said, well, you contact this radio station and they'll put you on a call-in show, which did happen. And two people called in, both in their 80s. One was a man who then owned the spot, and he had purchased it after the war, after the building had burned. And the other was a woman who, very young, had worked at Meadow Creek Lodge. And she said, oh yes, that existed, because she knew, she had seen guys going up there. You know, she knew that it existed. So it really did. Disadvantages of living here: you were isolated, you were distant from your families, some of whom never visited, and the economics and the logistics of a trip limited how often some people could leave. There was one single miner who was here for 17 years without ever going out. It was very confining, especially in the winter, and many people perceived a rigid class structure, sort of a Winston versus the circle. Many families did not associate with the single miners, which was typical of other company towns. In logging communities, the families typically did not associate with the single loggers who lived in the bunkhouse. There was a suspicion that many of the single men drank, and there was a suspicion that some were on the run from the law. I mean, and I know that the liquor was an issue because often the boys who were the paper boys did not go to collect in the bunkhouses without their fathers with them. Now, there are two myths that deeply offend some of the people who live here. One was that there was a liquor store. Some of the people who came early on when the Lutherans took over insisted that there was a liquor store because they found liquor store sales receipts. And I think it was in the store area. And many of us have talked about that, and I discussed it with the state archivist for this area who went through the liquor board records and checked. And she was able to tell me there was a tavern at Lucerne, but there was never a packaged liquor store anywhere up lake. So people could carry liquor into Holden, and they did. There's jokes about people going out with empty suitcases and coming back with full suitcases, but it was never sold here. The only thing that we can think about possibly happened is that liquor was hauled in by the salvage crews that came in immediately after the closure and took out some of the equipment. And the other myth that is perpetuated in, I think, in that little book that's in your room, is that the mine closed overnight, which is not true at all. The closure was announced in February 1957, and they announced that they would close the following summer. And which happened, it closed in late June. So the school year was completed and people had lots of notice. This followed a couple of years of warnings to new hires that this was going to be a short-term position. And actually, the publicity that was associated with the opening of the mine in 37 said that they felt there was enough ore here for 10 years of operation. So it was never intended to be a permanent community, and they never anticipated, actually even 20 years. And many people between February and June had found jobs elsewhere and had moved. And in fact, in the newspaper article that is up in the museum about the last day of school, they talk about how many children had left prior to the end of the school year. One of the most interesting stories that I ran into is I was interviewing by telephone the widow of the longtime office manager, and Mrs. Harriet Wilbur, who was a teacher, and she made a reference to, and that's where they kept the coffins. And I said, would you say that again? And she said, well, yeah, you know, they barged up coffins and they kept them, I think, under the dining hall. And of course, when you think about it, it made sense because there were very few deaths here. Most of them were health related. There were at least a couple of heart attacks. And there was a child who impaled himself on a hiking stick. But you, obviously, you had to go out. You didn't just go out on the Lady of the Lake. So they did keep coffins here.
So it didn't sound like there were any mining accidents? Or?
There were a few mining accidents, but very, very limited. And actually, Linda Jensen, whose father died of the heart attack, she chronicled all the deaths here. And I think there's a list up in the museum. There was a man who came out of his shift at night and didn't observe protocol. He was living in Honeymoon Heights. He cut across someplace where he shouldn't, and he was swept away by an avalanche. I think there was one death when Washington Water Power was putting in the power line, which, of course, that had nothing to do with the mine. They were doing it for the mine in the early 30s. And I think there was a death there. But there were no cave-ins. There were at least two heart attacks. Linda Jensen's father and then Nigel Adams's father died of heart attacks. There was a girl who died of polio, but she actually was out of the village, and she'd been sent to Seattle to a hospital. And there was a house fire, and people died in the house fire. But very, very few deaths. And I attribute part of that to the fact, I mean, I think they were very concerned about safety. And of course, in the era when this was built, safety was more of an issue. Also, there was not a railroad. And in timber communities, the railroad was the single most dangerous operation.
What do they do for law? Or how do they maintain law and order if you have these?
Most of that was the superintendent. And then there, at some point, they appointed someone a constable. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, Chelan, you relied on Chelan County. And I know there was at least one case of adultery that was handled by the superintendent. I think one minor went after another minor when it was discovered. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember if both of them were immediately shipped out. But I think there was a fair amount of that, you know, you just, if there was a problem, you were on the next bus mm-hmm. out.
Did you discover anything about any religious services at all?
Yes, they did. They had religious services in the what we call the Village Center, and it's exactly where we have them. And they had ministers come up from either Chelan or Wenatchee, and Nigel Adams, who was quite a storyteller, insisted that the Episcopal priest loved coming, because he did services, they were midweek services, and then he would go down into Adams's basement and drink home brew with the guys and have sort of an informal meeting with minors who weren't going to go to church.
Wherever there were three or four Episcopalians, there was a fifth, he used to say.
And there was a Catholic priest who came up. And in fact, Mrs. Wilbur's youngest was baptized by the Episcopal priest on one of the... the mothers did the Sunday schools and the Easter cantatas. I think anything that occurred on the weekends was community generated, but they did have a week, midweek services, which meant that somebody came up on the boat, did a service, stayed over, and then went back, which was typical in a lot of company towns. And there were other things that were available. The Episcopal Diocese in Seattle, so it would cover Western Washington, had a program that they started after World War II called Church by Mail. And you could subscribe to family devotions and Sunday school programs, and then they also sent out a trunk of books, both religious and general. And their mission was to serve people who were in remote communities.
Mm-hmm. Some time ago, when we were first coming up here, the myth about the end of it was when the mill shut down, because it ran 24/7 all mm-hmm. those years, and then when it finally did shut down, there was no noise, mm-hmm. and they knew yeah. that their job was over, yeah. and that was the quickness that I understood as mm-hmm. the story. And then they were in a hurry to get out of there because they wanted to get whatever jobs were available mm-hmm. down lake. So that was the part that was quick. Mm-hmm. When it finally shut down, they knew that was it.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is that they couldn't logistically all go at once.
True.
Because you couldn't get all that stuff out.
True.
And you had to bring a truck in. You had to plan ahead, in most cases, to get a truck to come up. And it had to be barged up, and then you had to pack your things, and they could only take so many vehicles out.
Mm-hmm.
I think the picture in the book shows 4 cars at the most on top of the canisters. But like when Linda Jensen's mother moved out after her father's death, her brother, I can't remember what the maiden name was, anyway, the uncle of the children brought a truck up, and then they cleaned out the house. And that was another example of community, is all of these miners, single miners that her mother did not know, just arrived and packed everything. So the mother didn't have to do anything. And of course, there was a case of beer that they carried over with them. But that was something that really impressed her, the community. I mean, obviously, they were friends, mm-hmm. but there were a lot of people that her father maybe had known, but her mother did not know. But no, people moved out gradually. And they said that after the closure was announced, there were several house fires, and there was some suspicion that there was arson
yeah.
because people then could collect mm-hmm. their insurance and then start fresh. Mm-hmm. And some people did take their houses out. They disassembled them and took them out and used them for chicken coops or utility buildings.
Did they close it because they ran out of copper?
No, they closed it because the government quit supporting the price of copper.
Okay.
And so the copper price dropped, and it was not feasible. And also, remember, the town at that point had operated for more than 20 years, and there were some infrastructure needs.
In the mine itself?
Probably in the mine itself, but also in the community, you know.
They were also having to pump because they'd taken most of the easy stuff they dropped down. Mm-hmm. So they're having to go down and pump, and that's a lot more expensive. Which is why, you know, now you see the stuff coming out of the front of the mine.
Mm-hmm. Was there any affiliation between the boat service and holding?
But the barge, there was a tugboat, and that was, I believe, owned by Howe Sound. The tugboat that actually pulled the barge that had the ore canisters. And then the Forest Service had a boat. Not everybody went on the Lady of the Lake. There were a couple of other smaller boats that ran midweek, say. And there was a Forest Service boat, because there was a forester here, just as there is today. And in some cases, that's how they got injured people out. And one of the women who was a nurse here told about taking somebody out. And it was Hal Fields' personal boat, Mrs. Fields' husband. And it was really rough on the lake. And she said she was petrified. And had it not been Hal Field running the boat, you know, she didn't know what she would have done. So.
Mm-hmm. How about they said there was copper and gold. Is there like
and silver.
Silver was there. Mm-hmm. Much of a... They said it was quite... Back then, gold was quite big here, or was it not, or was it... Some gold or just...
Well, there up in the museum, it tells how much they took out of each. But I think it was copper was so vital to the war effort.
Okay.
I mean, when you look at... There's a National Geographic story, and I know the clip is up there. When it opened, and they talked about it as a gold mining town. But then I think copper became so important because of the war.
I mean, the gold was really nifty because it gave you some more money on top of producing the copper, because copper prices move around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was very tough to really make much money on copper. But some of these other things were kind of the icing on the cake that gave you a little more money.
This was the largest producer of copper in the United States, and Britannia Beach, which the same company owned, Halsound owned, up in Canada, was the largest producer of copper in the British Empire. So, and it all went to Ruston in the Tacoma area, to the Asarco smelter.
There are some other camps that were around the area, but it seems like a lot of those were owned, the whole camp was owned by the company. The places that they lived, everything was owned by the company and not bought by individual miners.
Well, by the way, I should explain here that in Miner's Village, you owned your house, but you did not own the land. You leased the land from the Forest Service.
Just like now, yeah.
Just like what?
It's like we're leasing a lot of it now. It's leased.
And that's why it was required that the houses be raised. And that was another community where that was typical was Alpine on Stevens Pass. Has anybody read Mary Daheim's Alpine Mysteries? Well, this woman's family grew up in, or lived in Alpine, and so she recreated the town for a mystery series. But that was another one where the land was leased from the Forest Service, and so when the mill was no longer active, they required that it be raised. In mining, it was less likely that everything would be, in hard rock mining, that everything be owned by one, right. Although it was in Trinity, which is near here. I mean, it's in the same mountain range. Liberty, which you pass the cutoff for if you came across Blewett Pass, was not. They owned their own town sites. But so many miners just had, you know, little stakes. And in fact, that's what Oscar Getty did with his pack train, is he serviced all those miners. He had things like drums of diesel oil, which he got out to them. And, you know, they were here and there, but it was, you know, one-man operations. I think there was a lot more entrepreneurial. It was possible to be a one-man show in hard rock mining, where you couldn't be a one-man show with a sawmill, for example.
Right, right. And I guess some of the little places I'm thinking of were timber towns.
Yeah, yeah. What are you thinking of?
Well, Scotia.
Yeah, oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Oak Harbor, way up in around Oak Harbor. My sister-in-law's grandparents came from, they were Swede Finns, and they settled at the turn of the century around Oak Harbor in northern Washington, and there was a camp, and that's where they came to, was this camp. Lots of immigrants just came to the camp from the old country, and because it was the easy way to transition.
Well,
to
and the other thing is they were being recruited, and often what would happen is, like, there would have been somebody from their village who was already there, and he wrote home and provided the directions and maybe provided some financial help.
Right.
But there were, in the early 1900s, there were 1,500 timber camps in the Northwest.
Yeah.
And some of them had 50 people, and some of them had thousands. I mean, eventually, the Long Bell Company built Riderwood, which is outside Longview. And it was a little bit later. They built that in the 20s. But they had closed up operations in Missouri and moved out here. And they had 2,000 people in a high school in what was never considered more than a camp. And for a long time was accessible only by the company railroad. So yeah, there were, and it was typical for companies, logging companies, to have a sawmill and then have the camps where they were logging. That was so typical of railroad logging. That's what's so very interesting here is this is a community that could not exist. It was a, it was an operation that could not exist until there were trucks. Whereas timber communities, the camps, really dissolved once trucks became available because you no longer logged in just one place. Once you had trucks, people could commute, and the trucks could work in a number of locations. But in the early days in timber, they ran the rails in. They ran the camp in right on the rails. They had bunkhouse cars and a cookhouse car and a reading car and maybe even a schoolroom car. And then the logs came out. They logged as close, you know, as much as they could that was within carrying distance of the tracks. And so maybe they were there for 5 years, and then they moved everything out. They pulled up the rails, they laid the rails someplace else, and off they went. There was a community in Oregon that was owned by the Shevlin Hixon Company, and I think it moved 8 times between 1918 and 1950. And it was the rails. And I talked to somebody who had worked for Simpson Timber, which had a town built even later than this town. It was built after World War II in the South Olympics, called Grisdale. And he was a railway guy for Simpson, and we were talking about the train that they ran in. And it was called the Kalakala because people thought it looked like the ferry. And talking a little bit about the ride, and he said, well, you have to realize that when, first of all, you're on these rails that have been pulled up and been recycled many times, so these are not great rails. And then you're in a caboose at the end of a logging train, and it's whipping. Because the Kalakala had one long bench. You know, people talked about just sliding around and getting banged back and forth. And he said, well, think about it. And obviously, not being a train person and not thinking about recycled rails, I didn't think about it. And you didn't have to have a cushioned ride for logs. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was very typical. I mean, my mother lives near Eatonville. Mm-hmm. The Eatonville Lumber Company had their sawmill in town. But they had camps, like one that was on the rails, just a few miles outside of town.
And the store was owned by the company. Everything was owned by the company. And they hardly ever saw money because they were just surviving on that.
Well, the big issue is, in virtually every community, you didn't work 52 weeks of the year. And you had to eat 52 weeks of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But here, they did operate 52 weeks of the year. But in most timber communities, they closed down when the snow hit, or they reduced their work staff. Like at Grisdale, they laid off the single guys when the snow came and it closed the areas. And even in towns that operated pretty much around the year, they closed down for a week at Christmas and a week over 4th of July to do maintenance on the equipment. And that's typically when the bachelors went to town and spent everything they'd accumulated in the previous 6 months.
Or to Edgewood.
Yeah, Edgemont, yeah.
Did you discover the myth about, or is it a myth or not, the naming of Refrigerator Harbor down just on the other side of Lucerne?
I'm sorry, the misspelling.
Refrigerator Harbor, which is just around the corner from Lucerne.
I didn't.
Where they dumped the refrigerators.
Did they dump the refrigerators?
Yeah.
Well, that's the myth. I'm wondering if it's true or not.
It's a book about towns, not about the water adjoining the towns.
But you were mentioning Lucerne, and it's just, you can see it from Lucerne. It's just right around the corner.
When they dismantled their houses and something, took everything, they didn't take their refrigerators. Too heavy, couldn't get them on.
Then I don't know why they would have taken them down there. If you go through Miner's Village and you look, there's still car parts.
Yeah, right.
And, I would be really surprised.
I just thought it was cold down there.
Is that where it came from?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's hard to land the floatplanes down in there too.
I think you could still see refrigerators. This was years ago when
that wouldn't have made sense because there would have been no reason to bring a refrigerator down there.
Yeah,
just leave it.
maybe they thought they were going to get them on the barge and they wouldn't take them.
What was the population of Holden when it was, an active mine?
I would say about 600.
600.
And you can kind of think that through. There were 100 and some houses. From
Miner's
Village. And then there were the chalet, what we call chalets, plus there was an apartment for the doctor in Agape, which was the hospital. There was an apartment for the storekeeper where we have registration. That was this hotel steward's apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had, look at those bunkhouses. Look at how many people that accommodated. And then in the first 10 years, they had Honeymoon Heights. And then people lived at Lucerne and commuted up here to work.
No, how far is Lucerne from here?
12 miles?
Yes. Oh, okay, that's
where you came
from. That's where
you
came in.
Right, but there's actually a little town down there. Right?
It was.
Yeah, okay.
I think at one point there were 2 taverns. I don't think there was ever a store there. In fact, I'm almost almost positive there was never a store there. But there was a lot of rental housing.
And what's there now? Just the dock, that's it? Or is there actually a little...
No, there's a...
still a little town.
The Lakeland...
boat company.
Boat club.
There was a club.
Has the cabins that are left. There had been others that have been torn down.
Oh, okay.
And the ranger hunts down there.
And the Getty family still owns property down there. The children of Oscar Getty have... One of them has quite the house down there. And they come when there's a miners' reunion. Traditionally, the miners... the people who grew up here come every other year. They came last fall because they were supposed to come in 07 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the closure, but they couldn't because of the fires. And the Gettys always come.
Did the hotel ever operate as a hotel?
Well, that was the question I asked, especially when I was talking about the dating thing. And apparently it operated for visiting salespeople, for example, because you see, there was a the chalet that burned was what's the name for it? They had
I don't know. I'm
trying to
one,
remember
two,
what the name was.
Sorry.
But it was for single executives, and you could stay there, like the Wilbers when they were leaving. They stayed there the last night before, after they closed up their house, moved out of their house. They stayed there before they moved out. And so there was a place for company executives to stay when they came in. But I would assume there might have been people who stayed in a hotel like that. But I think it was sort of necessary to have rank to stay at the hotel. You had to be approved by management. So it wasn't like, say, your kids could come to visit you, and you could have them put up in the hotel. And the houses, most of the houses were very small, you know, bedroom, living room, kitchen, attic for the kids' bedroom.
Well, you can see, I don't know about now, but years ago we could see the foundations, you know, the size of them, like an oversized single garage.
Sort of built your own house too, right?
Yeah, they built their own houses.
You think about doing that.
And they, of course, went up because you needed that height. And then for heating, that made sense too. So, but again, that was really typical. You know, when I think about the house that I grew up in.
Yeah, they were small.
Nothing fancy.
Well, if you're told you're going to be here 10 years at the most, I mean...
Right, you wouldn't invest a lot.
And some people, like the Wilbers, when they came, they had made a personal commitment that they would leave when their oldest had to go to high school, that they would not send a child out. And, you know, a lot of guys came here during the Depression. That was actually part of what why they had to build family housing, is Howe Sound assumed that with the economic situation, men would be willing to come and live in the bunkhouses without their families. And that was true of some, but not of all. And of course, by 37, things had improved. And so that's what resulted in Winston being constructed. Because there were that was not part of the original plan.
Where did Winston get its name?
From the company that had done a lot of the work, Winston Brothers. And where else did Winston Brothers do famous work?
I'm not sure.
I want to say like the Narrows Bridge or something. There's some huge project in this area.
Deception Pass, maybe?
I don't remember, but I have seen the Winston Brothers' name as contractors, you know, major.
It wasn't a cigarette company.
No.
What exactly is Winston?
Winston is a miner's village, and if you walk down the road, there will be a sign. And it was raised after the Lutherans came. And I happened to see a book in the bookstore this morning that talks about the history of the flowers here. And I turned to a page where they talked about the garden club that existed here in mining years. And when the Forerunners came in the early 60s, one of the things they did was go down and dig up the flowers. And so there are still flowers here that came from those gardens.
Some of those cottages, or whatever they called themselves, some of them just were smashed by the snow because nobody was clearing them and keeping the ceilings intact.
And they were vandalized a little bit, too.
Oh, yeah. Vandalism, yeah.
That was something that I found notes on, was that there were guys who worked all day keeping the road clear, and then they went home at night and shoveled the snow off the roofs of their houses.
And they eventually just collapsed because people had left. And
yeah, because you had to do it on a daily basis.
Exactly.
And there was one story about, there actually were some structures there from the original effort to start a mine in the early 30s. And there was a family that went out for something, I've forgotten what, and a bear fell through the roof of their house in an instant. And, of course, got into the kitchen. And then was able to get out before they got home. But major demolition there, you know. Or shall we say vandalism.
Oh, maybe it's good the bear got out. What
means. Yeah, right.
But they could have had bear steaks.
Goldilocks came home.
So the book is at the bookstore if you're interested in taking a look at it. And if there's any other questions I can answer, I'll be happy to as we walk up to lunch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.